Okay, perfectly clear speech again. We're doing well. No pressure, Kevin. Now Kevin Sabet, our third speaker. Kevin, tell us what you think.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks, Mike, and thanks for everyone for coming to this discussion. I think it's an incredibly important discussion and one that really does get short shrift. It's not as sexy, it's not as glamorous as talking about sort of what legalization or legal regulation is like. And I think it's also just a lot more confusing. I think it's actually a lot more difficult for the reasons that both Bo and Dr. Redwar sort of discussed today. I remember, actually, Rob McCoon was one of my professors, and Bo was my TA more than 10 years ago at Berkeley, and we won't talk about where Rob has since gone to, since Berkeley. That was devastating to hear. I remember one of the first classes that we had on drug policy, he asked everybody to raise their hand if they thought California had decriminalized marijuana. Two people raised their hand. I was one of them, I think I'll proudly say. And I think there was about maybe one or two others out of a class of maybe 100. No one knew that California had decriminalized marijuana from 20 plus years. I remember another, and sort of, I'm gonna get into some stats and some slides, but I think these are important anecdotes. I remember another, my second day on the job in the Obama administration, we were getting together to talk about what would President Obama's drug strategy look like. And we had received a lot of input from different people. And one thing we heard is, we saw is, you should legalize drugs just like Portugal did. And I was like, well, wait a minute. And then they had like 10 newspaper articles, with the headline basically being Portugal legalizes drugs, use goes down, or Portugal legalizes drugs and harms have gone down. And it was, obviously for those of us who followed Portugal, we knew that they didn't, legalize in the sense of Colorado and Washington, and in reality, the supply is not legal at all, that it was simply sort of an administrative kind of process, which people like Alex and others have written a lot about. But that just showed the tremendous confusion about what was, about what people thought policies were. And then there was, another time where Massachusetts was considering to decriminalize marijuana in 2008. And when, somebody looked at, what is this proposed versus other decriminalized states? And it was completely different. So I just think this goes to the difficulty in these concepts. And people ask me, actually, and they say, when we're talking about, it's very clear where my views are on legalization. I think that, completely agree with John this morning, that we are on our way in the United States to creating a tobacco or alcohol-like model that, unfortunately, a lot of the good research that many of us do, and not me, but others do here, gets like, thank you for your work, we're going to shelf it while we listen to the industry. And that's very unfortunate. But, I get a lot of people saying, well, why don't you just come out and say decriminalization? That you're in favor of decriminalization, Kevin, because you've said, Kevin, that you don't want to see people go to prison. You don't want to see people low-level amounts get arrest records. Because one thing we haven't talked about yet is the devastating effect that an arrest record in this day and age of the internet can have. And you may not have served. We know that there's less than 0.5% of people in state prisons for marijuana possession alone. But we also know that 700,000, not people, but instances of arrest, probably a lot of overlap. We don't know how much overlap. Probably not enough to say that it's minuscule. I mean, it's like hundreds of thousands of probably different people have arrests every year in this country, usually resulting from a traffic stop or some other issue that was going on that marijuana was then found in the pocket or smelled or whatever, that would lead to an arrest that could be on that person's record. And so, Kevin, talk about decriminalization. The difficulty, though, and I don't think we've come up with a term, is that term is just terribly overbroad and unclear. Because my response is, okay, well, do you mean, youth or adults? Public or private use? Supply or demand side? Plants or no plants? 1 ounce, 2 ounces, half an ounce, 3 joints, 60? How do we define what that means? And so I think it's just been a task for the academic community to think about, what are some more specific and better terms? How can we talk about these issues more specifically and say, well, this is what I mean when I say that. And I don't think that happens a lot. So there's just so much confusion about what decriminalization means. If you looked at the headlines after Colorado legalized the supply of marijuana in November of 2012, One of our research assistants did this at UF. Over half of the headlines uses the word and articles use the word decriminalization. Colorado had decriminalized marijuana since 2001. Denver had legalized possession in the mid-2000s. That wasn't the new news of November 2012. The new news was that the supply is legal, we're going to have stores and we're going to have candy and advertising and all that. That was the news. But decriminalize was the word used in over half of the news stories. The coverage in Colorado, you can't use the excuse that these were papers outside the state. Many of them were in the state. So I do think it's terribly confusing. So I will go to the slides. I wanted to show this in case John didn't show it, but he did, which is very good. Obviously, just very quickly, and I'm going to talk about this in the next session at 2, but you know, what do we get with current legalization? I think we get rampant commercialization. Colorado is now the number one state for youth use in the country. The advertising and commercialization, and we think a thriving underground market that sells to people who either aren't 21, don't want to buy, you know, want to buy their marijuana outside of hours, and more importantly, don't want to pay the hefty tax. I walked into a Colorado shop after they legalized, and there was a dividing line between the store. And they asked me, Kevin, are you medical? They didn't say my first name. They didn't know my name. Are you medical? Are you recreational? They asked me. And I said, well, I don't know. What's the difference? What should I be? You know? And it was like, well, here's the thing. How much time do you have? Now, this was a strange question. How much time do I have? And they said, well, if you have about half an hour, we can get the physician here to do the review, $200 cash, and it's kind of like Costco. You get a membership card, and then you get discounts, like Costco. And by the way, they also had free samples. And so I said, well, all right, well, why would I do that? You've just legalized marijuana. People were dancing in the streets, you know, on the news. Remember the news coverage from New Year's around it? Because there's New Year's is a slow news cycle in the U.S. So there was so much out there. It was a huge news that on January 1st, 2014, you could go to a store in Colorado and buy recreational marijuana. I said, a week ago you were dancing in the streets about recreational. Why are you trying to steer me to the medical market? I get you get the $200, but is that the reason? And they said, well, because Kevin, the tax is not, you don't have the taxes you do on medical as you do in recreational. So if you have some time and you have a, you know, and then it was like, do you have a headache? Do you have a backache? What do you have? If you have something wrong with you, you get your card and you get your less tax. It was just very eye-opening to me, and it showed where things were going. I think the other issue we don't talk about as much, but it's connected to commercialization, is the promotion of special interests. Last week, in Colorado, a proposal for THC caps similar to the Netherlands. I mean, it's amazing. Rob hit the nail on the head when he said, we used to consider the Netherlands. That was like, oh my God, we never want to, you know, for those who were against legalization, like the Netherlands, we would never want to be like the Netherlands. Now we're like, can we please be like the Netherlands? You know, lower advertising, caps on 15% THC on a lot of products, fewer, I mean, it's just incredible how that has switched. But this just was... defeated in the legislature. There was a proposal for a limit on number and location of stores. There are, a Denver Post investigation found many more stores in poorer minority communities in Colorado than in the rest. Surprise, surprise, when you look at alcohol, very similar. So there was some legislation to try and limit that, failed. And then there was some other legislation in Washington, but also in Colorado, about where this money is going. What can it actually go to? Okay, we know we have the tax revenue. What can we do with it? And unfortunately, this was like a couple months ago in Washington State, that the proposal failed to divert it to prevention and treatment, even though that was the promise, diverted to the general fund instead, and I don't know, paying for salary increases and things like that. But that has been, I mean, maybe it's a uniquely American problem, very possible, a huge issue with the current thing. Now, I do want to flatter Bo by using his slide here on, this was a very helpful slide. This was the RAND Vermont continuum, 12 alternatives to the status quo. But as a good student, I'm going to challenge the teacher a little bit and say that while this is very helpful, in my mind, these were really just versions of legalization. In fact, I think Bo would agree that's what their versions of legal supply, which is what they were asked to do. But if we're looking at it outside the Vermont model, really the only U.S. model outside D.C. is the standard commercial model. This is where we've ended up. I think it might be helpful, and I just sort of took some time, not much time, so it's going to be very, very sort of, you know, a draft and really kind of cut and dry. I tried to look at what are alternatives to the status quo that do not involve legalization. So rather than the alternatives for that do not involve standard commercial model, what are the alternatives? And I threw out some, we threw out some things from some different places. Obviously, this is the administrative process, which we have nothing like that in the U.S. in terms of an administrative process for what would have been a criminal type of sanction. We don't, it doesn't exist in our system. Doesn't mean we can't create it, but it doesn't exist right now. But what do we have? You know, we have things like, you know, in many places. In fact, this is really, if you look at the de facto U.S. policy, I would argue that we're really in most places, I would say, except for some counties in the Deep South, fines and misdemeanor offense for use. Now, if you look at California, you don't go anywhere near misdemeanor in, for low-level use. It's a what they would call, they still call it a C summons, or it's a ticket, like a warning kind of thing. It's not, it's, that doesn't even reach misdemeanor. But so what are the different things? Obviously, Portugal, maybe what ASAM called for, assessment for use and referral to treatment. I mean, you could argue this is sort of the Dutch model, not enforcement. I mean, it's, again, it's incredible that we're sort of citing the Dutch model towards prohibition versus the sort of what we have in the U.S. now, but in many ways we are. You know, grow your own, perhaps in small amounts. You could argue that's a sort of model of Washington, D.C., but there's considerable controversy in D.C. now about should we have cannabis clubs, should we have, you know, sort of public spaces for that or not. That's an evolving policy. Do we just simply say, kind of what we said earlier, we're going to sort of ignore it, sort of like maybe the default Pakistan policy that, I'm not going to say that you said that, but, you know, sort of this default policy of we're just kind of going to imagine that it's not here and tolerate private use. And then we go into the non-commercial supply. And there's probably tons more in the in there that you could talk about. But I don't think this gets talked about a lot. And I think that, you know, we should try and think about what that would look like. The RAND report, I'm glad that Bo brought it up about sort of how much did Vermont spend on prohibiting marijuana. And in the year after decriminalization, as Bo mentioned, the criminal cases decreased 80%. So we know that there can be savings and costs about a dollar per year is what I think the report said, right? And so, you know, that was very helpful work from RAND to look at, you know, what's actually been done and what are the things that are the outcomes of that. I'm not going to go into these models, but my point is that I did a very cursory look in the U.S. to look at what models there are. There are scores of different non-criminal models in different counties and states all over. The state of New Jersey has a conditional discharge program. In other words, you get assessed to either get education or treatment. 90% of people get education. They're not referred to treatment. And then it comes off of their record. Like in Leon County, Florida, it's first time and second time is civil citations. In Maryland, there's a diversion program. In Montgomery County, which is the largest county in Maryland, Maryland State has a decriminalization law now that requires a kind of education. The point is that these things are being implemented. They're not as sexy as Colorado or Washington or, you know, Uruguay or other places that we discuss. But I think that they're worth looking at. And I don't think there's been a ton of evaluation. But I, again, with the caveats that not all decriminalization laws are alike. In the U.S., there's wide variation. In Europe, there's very wide variation. When you think about countries like the Czech Republic and Italy and Spain, being different from maybe some other countries. And so I think we have to realize that there is that diversity and sort of be on the same wavelength when it comes to the terms and make sure that we define the terms well before we talk about it. Otherwise, it sort of leads to a lot of confusion, but realize that there are many, many options and choices. I think, though, it's still a difficult question because, again, there are different circumstances. I would say almost you could argue that almost every kind of marijuana possession sort of interaction would be a different circumstance. Again, are they minors? Were they not? Were they using at the time? Were they not? Was it in public? Was it not? Were they driving? Were they not? How much was it? These are incredibly difficult questions that, you know, when you're in the legislature trying to have a blanket law for everything. I think one of the reasons we haven't seen a lot of this implementation is it's just a lot harder to do. But hopefully we can begin thinking about it. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin, and thanks to all of our speakers, bringing us in just about on time. So we have 20, 25 minutes for discussion and debate. usual format, put your hand up, I'll call on you to speak. Wait for the microphone to get to you because this is being recorded. And I think I'm going to have to ask the organisers, is this going out in Pakistan? Because I'll have to retract that earlier comment. So I'll check out the confidentiality aspect. So feel free to put your questions and opinions openly to our speakers, and I'll moderate the process of the question. So hands up, first up, please. Lady there, and then the lady there.
Thanks, I really enjoyed this. So Kevin, I certainly agree with you that there are a whole lot of different models that can be used, but one of the driving forces here is money. And how do you deal with that issue, that a lot of the states, and particularly as we heard earlier, that if one state starts to get all of the all of the financial benefits from it, and then it spills over?
I mean, obviously, that's a huge part of it, is money for states, money for industry, who gets rich? I actually just wrote an article about this for Mark's site on about.com. Who gets rich under decriminalization? Right. I mean, maybe if you get the $100 fine or something and you can afford it. I think there are some problems with the fine structures. And sometimes it's more expensive to collect the fine than it is to get, when you have the money. So, that's I don't have an answer other than... I think there does need to be, and this is probably, Bo can maybe speak to this, and it's going to be an incredibly difficult task, but you're going to have to make the case that the increased use that we already have and that people like Professor Calkins are talking about would dwarf any money that you would get. Right now, every dollar in alcohol and tobacco tax revenue that we get costs us $10 in the United States in social costs. It's about the same, 10 to 1 alcohol and tobacco. So I think you have to sort of try and make that case. But listen, if you're a legislator who gets voted in every 2 years and you have some pet projects that you want to do, who cares what's going to happen in 10 years with the social costs? Right now, your local county needs a new whatever. And if you can pay for it with the money this year that you get, you're going to be the hero versus saying, in 10 years, if we have this estimated increase in use that other people have called about, we're going to lose money. That's a different, more difficult political case.
The time right. lag, it's sure. also that it's different sectors that are going to be paying for
absolutely yeah. right exactly absolutely
thank you lady here
Kevin, this question is again for you. You showed a slide that said Colorado is now the number one youth right. state users, and that there's rampant advertising and commercialization, and there's that thriving underground market of white, gray, and black. But aren't those figures really the case even before the legislation? Didn't we have a high use rate in Colorado prior to that? Didn't we have, advertising, I think. It might be underground advertising, but it gets to the users who are interested in that advertising, right? So there's a tremendous amount on social media, websites, and I think there's a thriving underground market. Oh, yeah. No matter what, yeah.
So let's be clear. Colorado, my understanding, is the first time that they are number one in the country, 12 to 17 past month use, which is the marker that we use. That's according to SAMHSA's state estimates that they released in December. They've already always been high. I mean, they've always been in the top, not always, but they've been in the top 10 for a while. They're now number one. So that was what I was saying on the slide. Of course, they're under prohibition. The whole point is that there's a thriving underground market. Absolutely. My point was saying is that now we have the underground market. We have the legal market, which wasn't the case before legalization. That's the whole point of it by definition. And then we also now, as a result of the legal market, have the gray market. So we have I'm the older brother that's going to buy the candies legally and then sell them or bring them across to Nebraska or whatever. So that's what I was saying. And of course, I mean, yeah, I guess you sort of have advertising, the sort of your friend who, because most people get, of course, their cannabis from a shady, dealer on the corner in the underground market. It's from an older sibling or a friend or whatever, someone usually that they know. Of course, there's sort of, if you call this advertising, me telling you that this joint is really good and you should try it, yes, but there isn't, Walmart of Weed Mart, advertising on, the freeway or Free Dab. And I didn't bring the pictures because this wasn't really later today is the discussion on legalization. But no, before legalization, you didn't have Free Dab advertising on the freeway. You didn't have the candies and the cookies and all the things and the sodas being marketed. You didn't have the Sesame Street characters that they're using. You didn't have the degradation of women that they're having in multiple different coupons focused on 18-year-old men to buy, on the medical side. So no, I would argue you absolutely didn't have that before legalization other than the medical market. And now you have that. and that's the...
I see it in Craigslist a lot, even in the places where it's not legal, right? And in that back page. Right, yeah. Sure.
Okay, a lot of hands going up now, but it's first come, first serve. So gentleman there, and then the gentleman here.
This question is to no one in particular, but touching on the medical cannabis regimes that we see in so many different states, how does that help or complicate the decriminalization efforts that y'all are discussing?
That's a great question. I mean, as most of you know, I mean, I think now there are, what is it, 20, well, Pennsylvania hasn't passed yet, but 23 states plus the District of Columbia make allowances for the flower, and then there are, you know, as John showed earlier, I think they're now up to 17 states that allow, or that they're allowing the CBD oils. Whether or not you can actually get the CBD oils there is a whole nother story, but there's such a wide variation in terms of the different policies, you know, especially outside of the United States. California gets all the attention. It's so easy to get a card. The dispensaries are all over the place. It's very different in New York. It's, you know, very different in Vermont. And so I think the extent to which decriminalization would make a difference in terms of the criminal justice kind of expenditures and burdens is going to depend on the states. Like you know, California, I mean, everyone used to always be defined as a decriminalization state. You know, everyone thought they did it in the early 70s, but it still could possibly be a criminal offense. So it really wasn't until January of 2011 that it really became decriminalized. And there, I mean, you did see kind of a reduction in arrests. But in terms of the total criminal justice burden, I mean, there are a lot of people that already have heavy users that already have protections because they already had a card. So you can imagine in a place like New York, well, New York is already decriminalized, but a place that had a much smaller and more restricted medical market, I think decriminalization could make make a bigger difference there. And that's what happened in Vermont. Vermont already had kind of a small small medical system in place. But then from the year before, year after, went from 1,600 criminal offenses to 300, and so.
What happened in New York State is the medical society and organizations, we, and I was part of this thing, rather than opposing medical marijuana, we said medical marijuana needed to be approved by the FDA. It needs to be controlled, you see. And we sort of won over the governor. And so it is, it's a very different picture. And the physicians and you're told of the side effects and the advertising is very severely limited. And a lot of the people say, well, this is the worst medical marijuana bill in the country. And I sort of thought, wonderful, because I was a little bit compromising by even saying, well, maybe that's okay, face him. But so I think that, and so we have a different picture. Now, that may be overridden. The people were very angry at certain people when they want to change the law and go back. But so it's very controlled, and it's, you have to have scientific evidence for advertisement. There's a lot of stuff. It's a much more medical. It's not FDA approved. So the governor originally wanted to do research projects, first introduce research, but then the federal government gave, never, we won't go into that.
Just to add to that, I think the question again is about interaction between legalization and decriminalization. I have these here. It comes back to this question of objectives. You know, what objectives do you want to achieve with your reform? And can you achieve the objectives, or are you likely to achieve those objectives through different measures of different types of reform? So the question comes back to, is there a chance of achieving certain objectives through more moderate reforms, or can you only achieve those objectives by making bigger changes? That's the policy thought process. I have four on the list now, gentlemen here. And please wait for the microphone to come.
So the DEA is apparently considering rescheduling marijuana. This is a question for all the panelists. If the DEA says, all right, it's a Schedule 2, 3, or 4 drug, and we're going to enforce the law, what does that do to state recreational and state medical marijuana programs?
Do you mind if I start? So I think there's a huge amount of confusion about what rescheduling is. It is really a sort of arcane congressional term, legalistic, that has turned into a rallying cry for activists and some who think that they're speaking on behalf of researchers. Cocaine is a Schedule II drug. You can't buy, use or do anything with cocaine outside this extremely narrow research protocol, which it's very, very, very narrow. Cocaine, obviously, penalties. This is the best analogy I can think of. Cocaine penalties are much harsher than marijuana penalties on the federal or state level. But cocaine is Schedule II and marijuana is Schedule I. So people think, well, how is that the case? Well, it's because scheduling has nothing to do with penalties. And in terms of availability, actually very little to do with that. We have parts of the opiate plant that are Schedule II. You can't get them at a pharmacy because there's no of these parts that I'm talking about because you don't have a specific medication that has also been approved by the FDA. So I just want to say at the outset, it's amazing to sort of observe this thing. The other thing is I don't have special knowledge on this, but I would bet the house that DEA is not rescheduling marijuana this year or anytime soon because the issue is DEA has to consider rescheduling when somebody says, DEA, I want you to reconsider it. That can happen multiple times a year. There was one news story written in the Huffington Post a few weeks ago, and I'm glad there's going to be a journalist panel later, saying a true headline, DEA is considering rescheduling. Yeah, they've considered rescheduling every year for the last 20. It's nothing new. Unless we knew of new studies that said that there was a specific product that whole plant, whole flower marijuana in 2015, since the last time they made a determination, which was 2011, unless there's all those things have emerged, there's absolutely no reason to think that they're actually going to say, let's reschedule. Now, if they did, and that was your question, I'm certain they will not. They will not reschedule marijuana. If they did, it was Schedule II or whatnot, you still couldn't prescribe it and you still couldn't use it. It would make no difference. Because there's no specific medication that is approved by the FDA. Now, descheduled, which is now what Representative Blumenauer and the Drug Policy Alliance and Marijuana Policy Project, that's much more honest, I think, on their side, because descheduled certainly would make it like alcohol and tobacco. Rescheduling to 2 or 3 is not where the ball is at all. Yeah, go ahead. From Nida here.
Yeah. If it were rescheduled, it would help.
Yeah.
Just to say that the only thing that would be helped if it were rescheduled to Schedule II would be research, because there are some additional hurdles and burdens that go along with Schedule I for doing research, but everything else.
Of course, it wouldn't make it easy to do research.
No.
I mean, it's still very difficult. Schedule II. So I have actually argued that there are many other. Now that I'm not in government, I can do this. Many other things other than rescheduling, if you care about research, that you should focus on if you really want to do research on marijuana. That focusing on let's reschedule to 2 is missing the debate because there are so many things within 2 that are actually problematic even.
Bo, Norm, anything on this scheduling?
Yeah. The idea of the federal-state conflict is fascinating, and we hear about how because of this issue, we run into problems with banking. It's harder for the states to do testing. But what doesn't get discussed is the potential for opportunities, mm-hmm. right? To the extent that you have states that are now, you know, allowing mm-hmm. advertising, and so to the extent this is still all illegal under federal law.
Right.
The federal government could actually use its prosecutorial mm-hmm. discretion to shape these markets to say, you know what, you're not selling. You know, if you're selling gummy candies or any products that have THC over 40% or some threshold, you're going to go to the top of our list. You know, there's a lot of things that Cole Memo could have said that it didn't. But the thing to keep in mind is in January of 2017, we're going to have a new president. Mm-hmm. It's unclear whether or not that individual is going to continue down this path of the Obama administration or try something else. So earlier we were talking about how inevitable or whether or not it would be inevitable to have legalization. I do think in the short run, while we have this federal-state conflict, there may be things that we could do to help improve public health.
Okay, I have 4 questioners waiting. That's a fifth. So I'm going to take those, and that probably will take us through to the end of the session. What I'm going to take is the first 3 of those questioners before we ask for responses so we can get other questions put to the full panel. So we have Alex, yourself, and Angela. And you have you 2 at the back.
This is a question for Bo. If it is the case, which I hope it is, that we all agree that in the principle that it should not be a criminal offence to possess small amounts of marijuana for your own use, even if we don't like the term decriminalization. If that's the principle, surely the simplest way of doing that is just to legalize possession. And you talked about there being downsides to this, about the messaging it might send. But given, as we know from Kevin, that most people have no idea what the legal status of a drug is in their country, and they don't understand the difference between legalization and decriminalization. Yeah. So can you tell us more about what the mechanism would be by which legalizing rather than decriminalizing possession would be expected to have a greater impact on use?
No, I would just throw in a
final things about that.
Question, and that question I think needs a bit of thinking about. A couple of more questions. Lady in red in the front.
My name's Jody, and I'm really glad that you started with definitions. In Florida, I tell people that cannabis is legal. It's legal like dynamite as opposed to legal like spinach. I wanted to ask you about net widening. When I was in Colorado talking to folks in Denver with the Office of Marijuana Policy, they said that prior to the point where we started kind of mucking around, we being marijuana policy advocates like myself, that there were not a whole lot of arrests for cannabis use, but after we started mucking with the laws, that we then, they had laws that had to be enforced. So I was wondering if you had calculated into the net widening the idea that prior to some of these policy changes, officers might have been using a little discretion, they find someone with a little bit of marijuana and they dumped it instead of fining. And lastly, I just wanted to say, in terms of cookies and candies, I'm going to remind you all of chocolate milk of magnesia and Mary Poppins, who said a spoonful of sugar made the medicine go down.
We do apologize. Angela, and after this batch of questions, I'll go to the panel.
Just a comment on the question. A comment actually came after your comment, Mike, on this country outside the US that has a different thing. And indeed, I want to think whether the US is actually now is the extreme on this side, but probably has started on the extreme of this side on enforcing prohibition on cannabis in a way that many, many other countries in the world do not do. So I think it's really the two, I mean, typically of the US, if I may, having the extremes. If I may, so in general, if I can put the impact of, you call it, I think, Mike, you mentioned it, you know, the definition of depenalization, decriminalization. I mean, depenalization per se is allowed by the convention. And I think, I know that probably many of you are not very happy of the outcome of the UNGAS document, but actually the mentioning of de facto depenalizing, and is not only possession, you know, is minor offenses, so even goes beyond possession, can have an impact that is much greater. Maybe not in the US, where you had that big problem with cannabis, but outside the US, the impact on this, on other drugs, is probably much bigger than what it would be concerning the cannabis. So my question is, how much the debate on whether depenalization or decriminalization of possession goes beyond cannabis in the US?
Okay, so three questions there. I'd ask the panel to comment an observation. Taking into account we have 5 minutes left and two more questioners, so brief comments at this stage.
Very briefly. So, no, you're right. And so that's the whole idea behind net widening is, whereas before the cops may have just kind of confiscated the cannabis and thrown it away, now they may be more likely to apply a ticket. And so, and that's something we really have to pay attention to with respect to youth and kind of what happens here. So it'll be fascinating to kind of see how this plays out in Washington, Colorado, and the other places. And Alex, what I was just trying to think about some possible downsides to this, and I don't have any evidence to back this up. One possibility, though, is to the extent that even within the United States, if you were to look at all of the different laws kind of for possession, and it would be hard for you to pick out what are typically the decriminalization states. So the idea potentially is, if one state just decides to legalize possession now and it gets confused with just general legalization, then maybe that could send some signals. I have no idea about whether or not that would actually be the case, but I could see it potentially being different than kind of how we have decriminalization now. As I said, I'm not necessarily advocating for that. I just think it's something to think about here. And to the extent that you could do something like that with a sunset clause, wouldn't be as much of a risk.
I'm not sure. I think that this whole thing is the health standpoint, which we heard less, the addiction and all of that, and that's the elephant in the room that people don't want to talk about, and the cost for that and all of that. I think it's the problem with the decriminalization, I mean, with the legalization, it has to do with the advertising, but now we have advertising anyway. And I think that, you know, if there was a way we could outlaw advertising and promotion, that would be wonderful. We could do a lot of things. But you can see as a doctor, we just see these problems with the opioid. That's part of the opioid problem, OxyContin and so on, and whatever it is. So we see advertising promotion, and then on the other hand, where the emergency rooms are filled with people and lives falling apart and families. So from our standpoint, you know, we call in the policy people. What can you do? And if you're going to, you know, decriminalize it or legalize it, whatever, let's do something to decrease the health risks. And what we heard downstairs, I really appreciated, the health risks are going to get worse, and the number of people affected, and the kinds of people that are going to be affected.
Just very quickly on what Angela said, I think you're right about the extremes from one side or the other. And actually, you know, in this discussion of the opiate and heroin epidemic, there have been, you know, people, governors and others calling for, you know, bring the death penalty back, bring the, you know, and so this is, I think, a worry of American public policy generally about sort of quick reactions to something and trying to, I think so so actually that's why maybe I'm in the minority in this room. I find the ACRIM document very helpful because I think it actually helps to chart out what would more of a, for lack of a better term, middle ground look like, that is in UN term speak, not really US speak, but principle of proportionality, where we would want to make sure that we're not going overboard. But also I think we also would want to understand that this is a much more nuanced issue. So, you know, if somebody, you know, is just in possession of a small amount of any drug, how is that different from somebody who's in possession of a small amount and that is fueling crime and other things? And how does one policy, whether it's treatment only or legalization only or throw them in prison only, apply to such a complex biobehavioral issue as this is the trick?
Okay, thanks. And we have two more questions. I'm determined to get this in. So we have Steve at the back and the gentleman there. Please place your questions as quickly as you can.
I missed the beginning of the session, but one of the things that you mentioned, Kevin, was about you touched on cannabis social clubs in your spectrum. And I think it's quite interesting that you have the cannabis social clubs are a model that nominally, at least, operates within a decriminalisation framework, although obviously it's operating in a kind of legal grey area, and it's not officially endorsed by the Spanish government, but it also hasn't been condemned as sitting outside the UN treaties by the INCB. And it's a sort of de facto legal supply club model for small groups of people that seems to, when it operate quite well, in that it's a non-profit system. A lot of the sort of commercial imperatives that people have been worried about, that we talked about this morning, aren't present. And so what you've got there, I think, is an interesting way in which, within a decriminalisation framework, you're seeing a sort of transitional model towards legalisation that may be actually quite a positive framework for how we should be thinking about legalisation and regulation in terms of non-commercial regulation. I just wondered if anyone was interested in commenting on that as an aspect of the decriminalisation discussion.
Okay, panel to the panel in a second, but first you, sir.
Thank you. This question is to Bo. You talked about some of the decriminalisation movements creating some tension between the police and the community. I wondered if you could just talk about that a little, because I could see two different trends, perhaps. One is that the police very much opposed the nationwide movement to have concealed carry laws because they were concerned about violence and the like, but they seem to have come to accept that. And I'm wondering if the same sort of result will happen with marijuana legalization. On the other hand, I know there are police officers who use marijuana presence as a basis for making an arrest, not because they want to enforce that law, but because they want to use this person as a source. They now have something over this person, and so they can use this person to find out about what's going on in the neighborhood and the like. And if you decriminalize it or completely legalize it, the police who used to do that now won't be able to do that, and so they'll be unhappy. So things can go in either direction in that regard.
Okay, thanks for those two questions. Observations from the panel on that?
Just quickly before the panelists start, it is now past 1 p.m. You have an hour until the next session begins to get lunch. I just wanted to let all of you know so you wouldn't feel rushed.
Steve, I was talking about this within the context of Washington, D.C., obviously where they're going, and I think in terms of the INCB, I mean, I hope Wayne Hall is not in here. I mean, there's probably three people in Washington, D.C. who know who the INCB is, first of all. But more to the point, I think when you talk about, again, American style, we talk about American style legalization versus Dutch style. It's like some of us are longing for the Dutch style, which we never thought we would say. And that's because it is in such sharp contrast with Americans. So what happens that if it goes forward in Washington, D.C., I would be very surprised if it follows the sort of slow and steady, calm and quiet social club model that we've seen in Spain and maybe one or two other countries versus a much more leaning commercial model, even if it is sort of a social club model. So that speaks to needing to, I think, set the context of where you're talking about. And so I think that would lean much more towards sort of the full legal model than the other.
Yeah. Paul, to your last point, this argument that by arresting people for possession, it could provide intelligence to that would be useful to the police. I hear this argument. I've seen no empirical evidence for it. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but that's why not give it, if you're going to, really try to address this, if you were to legalize possession with a sunset clause, try it for a couple of years. If it turns out that the police really don't like this because they're losing all this information, that then you could take that to help make decisions about what to do next. And so I do think that might be a possibility, but I just haven't seen any evidence for that. And Steve, with respect to the cannabis clubs, we were trying to keep this mostly focused on just possession. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right. When we're talking about these middle ground options, in the United States, so much of the focus is on either prohibition or the for-profit legal regime. But once you go outside of the United States, people are much more likely to talk about some of these other options that may be more ideal from a public health perspective. No.
Yeah, and I'm not a lawyer, but I think my view is that you can have good laws and then they're not done correctly. Like the stop and frisk thing, is just was a terrible thing. But in our area, they do pick up people for things. People don't know the laws. They get information. A lot of my patients really get hurt because of this. And then I have other people whose lives get saved by going to prison, some of my recalcitrant opioid addicts. So that doesn't give you any answers, but maybe makes you more. The law is like a scalpel, isn't it? You can stab somebody, you can take somebody's appendix out. Mm-hmm.
That's good. Okay, thanks very much for those final observations from the panel. And thank you all to you. Kept us a vibrant debate, largely on time. We haven't eaten into your lunch too much. Good luck for a fruitful conference. Thank you.